This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Among the new courses on offer this term are new Katana lighting training, a world first with Matt Leonard. Included in that is free VPN access to a full version of Katana, along with many other key programs to help you learn, such as Arnold, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and just heaps more. All there to help you take your career to the next level. Check it out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX Show, our annual Oscar special. And I'm joined here at the VFX Show by, I nicknamed him Todd the Predictinator, but I wasn't the first. Todd, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Mike?
Good. And Matt, welcome you back. How are you, Matt Wallen?
Thank you very much. Yeah, doing good here.
So as we did last year and as we like to do, we're going to discuss the VFX Oscar category. Now, we've discussed most of the films that have been nominated. In fact, I think we've probably done a show on all the films that have been nominated, but I just think there's some really interesting aspects to the Oscars. And it's not just about who's going to win, though that is an interesting part about it. But there's a lot of stuff that deserves a bit of attention as part of that discussion as to what's going on. But I think we should predicate this, and I'm sure Matt and Todd, you'd agree with me, that you don't get to be nominated without producing excellent work. So right out of the gate, we should just say that all of the films, and in many of the ones, I would say in the bake-off, just could easily have won in any given year, depending on what was happening, especially this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it should almost go without saying, but yeah, I mean, really, if you're doing work on the level of any of these films that have been nominated, it's really top shelf stuff all the way.
Yeah,
the competition is just outrageous. I mean, the Bake Off even big enough? I mean, some of these films that are in the Bake Off would easily have won just even a couple of years ago. So it's pretty outrageous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to say that there's a couple of themes. So before we just get to Todd's amazing work in actually putting together a complex algorithm to determine what is likely to win the Academy Award, let's just discuss the five films that did make it through the Bake Off, just in general terms. So in no particular order, The Hobbit, Part 1. And I'm going to say that The Hobbit, for me, is indicative of what we're seeing in many of the other films, which is incredibly strong character work. Wouldn't you agree, Matt? I mean, Gollum, for example, just spectacularly good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Gollum and what's some of the other ones? The is it the Troll King and or is the Trolls
Goblin
and
King?
Then the Goblin King? Yeah, yep. I mean, and you know, from a character animation point of view, the level of quality in both the animation and then, you know, with Gollum, you know, the degree to which they've sort of pushed the envelope of, you know, sort of the previous iterations of that character. I mean, you know, it's really just, you know, some of the best kind of stuff that that Weta's done, you know, certainly with that genre of the films that they've worked on.
Yeah, Todd. I mean, it's interesting to see a character revisited with a sort of a decade of technology in between, isn't it? We don't often get that luxury.
Yeah, not really, and especially almost a completely, on two fronts, a different medium, not only of going from mono to stereo, but classic 24 frames per second to 48 frames per second, and yet this is a world that we've all kind of been in before, and these are characters that we've seen glimpses of before, but yeah, it's not a rare opportunity to see something like this, where we get to see these same characters in a completely different world, and really taken to the next level in terms of how these guys can live in close up so unbelievably beautifully, like particularly Gollum.
And I mean, that theme of characters, I think, drives obviously the Avengers. I mean, Hulk for me was the, you know, third rail that no one wanted to grab. In fact, I would say there would have been a Hulk film had anyone thought they could have made a Hulk as good as they made an Avengers before they made it, because, you know, the previous two Hulk films just didn't excite fans, didn't excite the box office, and certainly didn't technically seem to deliver the absolutely believable Hulk that everyone was hoping for. I was very critical of Ang Lee's hopping, skipping version. I thought it was point blank, just absurd. And I say that with due reverence to the fact that, of course, it's ILM that's come back with the one in... but the character work in Avengers really was up against it right from the word go, because we just had this expectation of, uh-oh, you know, are they going to manage to pull it off? And, I mean, audiences, I think, universally loved the Hulk.
Yeah, I mean, I think Avengers 2 is, you know, a great example of both the character animation aspect, but also... the degree to which the film and the visual effects, in terms of sort of fan expectations and just overall entertainment value. I mean, it was such a huge, both financial success as well as, like you said, Mike, a real, I mean, it's just a real crowd-pleasing movie. I think, you know, it's really pretty universally enjoyed by fans of sort of that genre of film anyway, the sort of Marvel comic superhero films with Joss Whedon, you know, directing the movie, and then ILM's great work. You know, I think you really get a great combination there that really just comes together in a way that, you know, is just so much fun.
Yeah, and in Prometheus, we saw the engineers, but not only in that. I mean, in Spider-Man as well, we saw advances in subsurface scattering that just led to incredibly good results. I mean, Prometheus is a very strong subsurface scattering example, because, you know, you have that almost wax-like skin. And Todd, I mean, they it's been amazing to see that development and the level of subtlety needed to pull off a really good subsurface character work. But you just don't get that kind of realistic character. Well, semi-realistic, I guess the engineers aren't that realistic, but, but, you know, without really good subsurface scattering algorithms.
Yeah, and particularly just from a straight-up art direction standpoint, the work in Prometheus is beyond reproach. I mean, from the space shots to landing on the surface of the planet to being on the surface, I mean, pretty much every frame is gorgeous.
There is shots of the spaceship coming into the planet that were done by MPC that I think we mentioned this at the time, are spectacularly good. But not only spectacularly good, these guys had to jump the bar that had been so highly set by just about every other sci-fi space movie, that to sort of say, I want a breathtaking shot of a, you know, ship coming in on the planet, you'd be like, right, like we've never seen that before. Yeah. And to come up with something that I remember even at the trailer stage, just almost gasping over, I just thought it was beautiful work, just magnificent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Snow White or the Huntsman is just a really interesting film to have in this top five. The kind of troll work in that, I think, is one of the things that made me go down this theme of character work. It had a lot of interesting visual effects in it, but I don't think before it came out I would have given you any odds that this would have made it into the final five. And I say that based on having not seen the work. I wouldn't have said that there's no way a Snow White film is going to make it in. There were two coming out. I thought it was a joke. I was like, really? Do we need two Snow White films, let alone one? And yet here it is, beating out some other big films like Spider-Man to the top five. And again, you know, character work and very, very good control of light. I thought it was just it was a surprise, and I give the guys full credit for being able to pull it off, that seamless integration they did. But because fantasy can be a bit, you know, you just lose the reality and I don't care anymore. But they managed to pull it off. Don't you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, and that was a show too. I remember when we did the VFX show on it, like, I was sort of, I just remember sort of not being that excited to go see the movie. I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll take one for the team and I'll go check this one out, because I just didn't think it would be something that I would enjoy. But I actually really enjoyed the movie, and I thought some of the work in it, I remember at the time, some of the, I believe a lot of it was sort of face replacement stuff and some scale gags too, with the, like Ian McShane and some of the other actors that played some of the, you know, the dwarves and stuff. And a lot of that stuff just really took me by surprise. And I thought a lot of that stuff was just really great. And then, you know, like we talked a lot, I think, in detail about some of the sort of the shatter simulations that were done in the particle sims to create some of the sort of the, I think they were kind of almost like crystalline, sort of obsidian-like shattering of some of the characters, and that work was really great too. So, I mean, it wound up being really quite an interesting and diverse set of visual effects that were in.
Yeah, it's similar to like the Harry Potter films, where there's definitely an element of magic involved, but there's all these character work that's really, you know, for Snow White to make it as a nominee against a film like John Carter, which had some unbelievable character work. I mean, it says a lot for the talented folks at Snow White to get this nomination.
It's also really interesting to compare and contrast the problem they solved in the Dwarves, because we have such an interesting example to compare it to with The Hobbit.
Yeah. Yep.
Both films, I guess The Hobbit in many respects built off the previous sort of forced perspective. Now, they couldn't force perspective because they were shooting in stereo and stuff, and so they did this elaborate trick of having motion control cameras hooked up, so you're filming two sets at different scales with a ratio built into that motion control between one to the other. So a very elaborate solution, works very, very well, but a completely different solution offered by Huntsman with the face replacements, as you mentioned, Matt.
Something as simple as the framing on the in Snow White, the framing of the dwarves. Did you notice that they gave them a lot of headroom just to kind of subconsciously remind the audience that, yeah, these guys are dwarves, and on all the close-ups, whereas Peter Jackson wouldn't necessarily do that on The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings films. Boy, that dwarf work in Snow White was – it took me like a few shots to go, wait a second, is that Ian McShane? How is totally, that possibly Ian McShane?
That's exactly like my reaction to it too, because I mean, I had been watching some years before, I guess, watching all the HBO series Deadwood, where I mean, he's just such a magnetic actor on screen. Mm-hmm. And then I'm watching this film and I'm like, that dwarf sounds so much like the guy from Deadwood, like that's so cool. And then I realized, like, wait, that is the guy from Deadwood, like, no way. But it definitely crept up on you. And then when you saw it, it was so seamless. I couldn't.
And you're like, is that Nick Frost? Wait a second. What's going on here? It's really impressive work.
Yeah. And when you think about it, I mean, I remember seeing the face replacements in Titanic. And at the time, it was really impressive. They're running up the corridor, the water splashing up behind them. But, if you watched it the second time and were looking for it, you were like, well, yeah, that didn't really work that well. And this one, I did the same thing you did, which is like after a few shots, I started staring at their faces like, okay, I'm going to get this because I'm a compositor in my DNA. And like, oh my God, how do you do that? And we are so programmed for reading faces. But to get back to characters for a second, because the elephant in the room, which is, of course, the tiger in the room, is Richard Parker for Life of Pi. And we can't discuss a theme of characters in films without – now, he wasn't the only character work done in Life of Pi, but, oh, my God, he's the one that everybody has zeroed in on. And for good reason, Todd.
It's really outrageous, especially talking to some of my fellow visual effects professionals who did not necessarily realize that it was whenever the tiger was on the lifeboat that it's 100% computer graphics. This tiger was just unbelievably accurate. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just inscrutable. I could just watch it, these sequences over and over and go, yeah, okay, so they had a tiger on set and it was just very well trained, and they sat around and waited for the right take to be able to give the emotion of the scene. Like, in that take he made eye contact with the actor. Oh, that's great, we'll use that one. No, it's all CG. Amazing work.
Can I tell you a funny story? I was doing a tiger ad. I hope I haven't told this story before on the show. I was doing a tiger ad. It had this tiger and it was meant to be walking through a blue screen set. Anyway, so we go to the pre-pro to look at the tiger, and it's in its natural environment, which is its home where its trainer kept it. And it's completely calm and it's a sunny day. And it's just sitting out there in the sun, and the trainer's there, and everyone's really relaxed, and we're talking, and we walk up to the tiger, and everyone's really calm and collected, and it's all good, and it looks like a big pussycat, right? And I'm like, oh, great, can I take some photos of it? Like, the camera won't disturb. No, he says, like, the cat, it's all the time, it's just the photos. It's not a problem. So I start taking photos of this tiger, and it's in the sun, it doesn't look even slightly bothered. And I get down on my knees at one point at, like, camera height, and he goes, I'd get up if I was you. And I, like, got up, and he went, yeah, I wouldn't be doing that, mate. And I went, what? Because I wouldn't be getting lower than that tiger, not if you're in paw's reach. Ooh. And I was like, what? You got to warn me about that. And he goes, oh, yeah, that was a pretty stupid thing to do. And I was like, what? But nobody said it was a stupid thing to do. And he goes, well, it's a goddamn tiger, mate. I was like what? He just looked at me like, you are the biggest, stupidest, city-ass moron that we've ever had the misfortune to have out here. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go now. yes. And the second half of that, which I probably have told the story, but I'll tell it anyway, is I'm on set, and at one point the tiger missteps on the blue screen set, and it hurts itself a little, like in the sense that, you know, you would bump into a door, you'd hurt yourself, not actually hurt itself. Anyway, it lets out this growl that resonates in my bones. Like at DNA level, it said, run for your fucking life. Like, you are going to die. Like, seriously, dude, move. And I look around, and most of the crew is up a huge scissor lift, and I'm on the ground with the DOP and the guy with a gun. And I say, to reassure myself, and the trainer, by the way, who is now being dragged across a concrete floor by the tiger on a chain, luckily away from us, and I say, mate, I am so glad I'm standing next to you. And he goes, why? And I said, because you've got the gun. And he goes, oh, mate, this is a tranquilizer. This thing will have finished eating you and be picking its teeth by the time that takes effect. And I said, well, why am I standing here with you then? He goes, mate, I wouldn't be if I was you. I was like, oh, my God. Note to self. So anyway, getting back to the movie. I thought that this character was really good, but if I can beg your indulgence for another anecdote, we were lucky enough to sit down with the guys from Weta who developed Tissue. Now, Tissue is the flesh simulation tool that's used by Weta. It used it firstly in Avatar, and then it's refined it ever since. And I was surprised they don't even use it in things like Tintin. And I might come back to why. But the point is, they use it as full-on character animation work. And for those of you that don't know, clearly, normally there's an underlying skeleton, which is like a mathematical skeleton, like an IK skeleton, and you would move this, and through a series of stuff that a TD has rigged up, it causes the skin on the surface of whatever object or character you're moving to bend and stuff. And obviously, a more advanced character like the ones we've been discussing goes far, far beyond that. And in the case of Weta and Tissue, which just won a SciTech award, it models a real skeleton, which then in turn models fibers in actual muscles, which are volume preserving and actually properly contract using finite element analysis, which then affects a fascia, which affects a fat layer and then a skin layer. So what you're seeing on the surface of a skin of, say, Gollum is completely driven, but animated control, but driven by this incredibly complicated simulation process that gets you what happens on the surface. What I'm mentioning this now is that when we were talking to Bill, the VFX supervisor on Life of Pi, we were discussing this idea, which of course, you know, you move the paw of the tiger and it would cause a series of muscles and maths to happen that would give you an accurate skin, which then would have the fur rendered over the top of it. But he pointed out that while being state-of-the-art to most concerns, wasn't even enough for Pi, because the tiger actually tenses its muscles before it pounces. And if you think about it, all of those models that I just described are predicated on the muscles being moved by the bone moving, not the other way around, which is, of course, what happens in real life. You know, you can imagine your brain signal sends a muscle signal that tenses and then flexes and then, voila, it springs. And so you just have to think about the kind of level that these guys had to go to get that accuracy. This is just a technological feat, and that's before you even get to the rendering, which I thought, Todd, was just spectacular.
Well, it's funny, you know, in computer graphics with characters, we because of the tools, because of the horsepower, we've always kind of figured out ways to cheat reality, and now we're getting to the point with all these creatures and characters. Now we're just building those characters. Well, how are you building it? Oh, you know, like, their bones and their muscles and their skin, and we're just kind of building them from the ground up, and now that's actually, like you said, it's affecting how we animate as well. We're not just going to be animating skeletons or rigs, you're animating muscles which will move bones and skin, and this is just astounding stuff, and boy did it pay off in spades for Life of Pi.
Yes, well, that discussion we had, if I can just do some cross promotion here for a second, that discussion we had with the Tissue team is coming out on FX Guide TV, and that discussion with Bill, the VFX advisor of Life of Pi, is coming out as part of our Oscar FX podcast discussion, so he can discuss that in more depth, and including one of the other huge aspects, which is the perception we have that the skin on the tiger was kind of moving over the sort of bones in a way that you don't really see on people at all. And of course, it isn't really free, the skin from the body, but it does have that look that it's kind of swaying around especially around the torso, in a way that you would think it was almost not attached. And I guess a cloth sim is the closest thing you can think of. But we mentioned subsurface scattering before. Subsurface scattering, Matt, was really significant in a lot of these creatures' furs, weren't they? Because they were using subsurface on the fur now, which, again, adds to the realism of getting these things rendered.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and just on Life of Pi, too, I just have to say, you know, for my money, I mean, that really is, you know, the visual effects movie of the year on so many levels. I think, you know, just the scope of the work and the integration of the work into the larger framework of the story, and the sort of unusual nature and sort of the sort of, I almost want to just say the sort of the high art of the nature of the composition of a great deal of the shots in the film, and which I think we talked about in the VFX show on Life of Pi a few weeks back. But yeah, I mean, just the level of sophistication, like you say, right down into the rendering of the fur itself. I mean, it's just really amazing work.
So let's talk now about the Oscars. And I want to just really say now that there are two aspects to this. There's our aspect of what we may think might win from a personal level. Now, that could be that, for example, I might think Life of Pi would win. I may not think Life of Pi is the film that I would vote for, but there are a lot of reasons why we think something might win the Oscars. And then there's the reason that, well, say, Todd might think something might win, which is based on more than a hunch. And so we just want to be really clear about this. Once we're discussing this Oscar stuff, we're not saying that, you know, this is our personal opinion on what deserves anything, because I really can't get over this enough. Getting to be one of the top five, these five nominated films, that is awarded by your peers and denotes a standard of excellence that is just really, truly to be celebrated. What goes on to win, that's got a whole bunch of other factors, okay? And so let's not pretend for a second that every year the best film, the most deserving, the most innovative, the best Oscar film from a VFX point of view has won the VFX Oscar. There are just reasons why things win. And Todd, I guess you're in a really good position to either agree or disagree with that statement.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, not to get too philosophical here, but, you know, anybody who's worked as in the capacity of an artist in a competitive field where there are something called awards, it is really ridiculous to be, you know, handing out the best actor. I mean, what is the best actor? Did all five actors play the same role and you're putting them all up against each other and, you know, looking at the sequences, oh, let's see how they did here. It's all kind of ridiculous. I mean, truly getting the nomination, particularly in the case of the Academy, which in the visual effects branch is determined by your peers, not the full Academy. So getting that nomination is an enormous honor, and trust me, having written about with the Predictinator and all these articles, I have to stress exactly what you said. This is not about what we think necessarily, depending on your discussion, what should win or what deserves to win, or what it should, you know, who is rightful for the Oscar winner for this thing. It's not like that. We're talking about history. We're talking about what the Academy, the broad Academy voter membership likes and things like that.
I was going to say, I would have thought Dark Knight Rises would have made the top five. So my tastes aren't in sync with the Academy, clearly.
My predictions as well. I got four out of five right. I thought Dark Knight was going to be in there, or Dark Knight Rises, I should say, instead of Snow White. But I got four out of five right. That's not bad.
What were you going to say, Matt?
Oh, yeah. And I was just going to say, too, like, you know, and in particular with regards to just visual effects, you know, this being the visual effects show, I still do feel like, you know, in a lot of ways, the sort of more recent, I just did my, cast my ballot just this afternoon for, the 11th annual Visual Effects Society Awards for all the nominees. And I think, you know, when it comes to the visual effects branch of the Motion Picture Academy, so for the Academy Award, it's a smaller voting arm than what you get, you know, even in the in terms of sort of the diversity of the group, I think, than you see in even like the VES Awards, which is a completely different body, of course, but is a much more granular look at the essence and nature of visual effects themselves. Whereas I think in the Academy voting branch, you know, it's a much sort of broader spectrum. You know, it's not quite as narrowly focused either. So, yeah, I think the degree to which, you know, I mean, you know, it's an honor to be nominated, as they say, I think, but it's also, you know, it's really, it comes down to a set of factors that are somewhat ephemeral and a little bit outside of the scope of, you know, maybe what you might expect at times as well.
Okay, so now to set it up for those of you that haven't worked this out, Todd's actually produced this algorithm. He's done it, and it's predicted retrospectively very accurately and then predicted ahead very accurately for what, the last three, 4 years?
The last 3 years. This will be the fourth year it's tested.
But you did predict, you did run the algorithm over previous years, and once the algorithm was perfected, it managed to predict very successfully previous winners, if that makes sense.
Right. It predicted in 2009 for Avatar to win. It predicted Inception to win the next year. And last year, it predicted Hugo to win, which it did.
Has the algorithm been tweaked?
No. We're using the exact same formula we made for all the data between 1989 and 2008. We said, okay, we're locking it here, and let's see what happens. I mean, we figured with that much... that many years of accuracy, and we're in the CG, you know, this is the CG part of our history of visual effects, and that's why, one of the reasons why we started in 1989 with the Abyss's Oscar win in 1989. We said, okay, this is a pretty good formula. Let's just see what happens. And so we're 3 for 3 now, including that really, really tough year last year, which Hugo, I mean, some may say that, you know, yeah, Inception winning, oh, big deal, you guys predicted that. Or Avatar winning, oh, good, really nice job. Hugo was a tough call. And I, as you remember, a year ago, right on this podcast, I was skeptical of my own formula. And sure enough, it worked out. So until it breaks... for, you know, many years in a row, I don't know. It was so much work to get to this point. I don't know. We're going to stick with this for a while.
I spoke to Rob Legato before the Oscars were announced about the fact that you predicted it. And yes, it was a private discussion, but I will say this, that it was an interesting discussion talking to him. That was actually, I think, about a week before the Oscars came out. Okay, so let's cut to the chase and then we'll cut back, because I don't know that there's going to be much of a surprise in this. Tell us who you're predicting, and then we'll go back to how.
The Predictinator is predicting Life of Pi. It's a fairly decent win. It's not an overwhelming win in terms of the numbers and the total score, but it's similar to actually how Hugo beat Harry Potter and Rise of the Planet of the Apes last year. But Life of Pi.
Now, you've entered a bunch of stats, and we're going to discuss those in a second, but... I think I'm going to sort of not challenge you on this, but I'm going to say some of these aren't quite as numerically clean cut as this idea of a formula might imply. And I'm going to start by saying that there are a couple of things you have to decide. Like, for example, an easy one is this a sequel?
Yes.
And we had that question on Planet of the Apes. I would say the same question comes up very clearly on Hobbit and to a certain extent on Avengers. So let's start with that category. It factors into your equation. Is it a sequel or not? And did you rate The Hobbit as a sequel, or is there a special category for prequels?
We, because I was looking back at historically what we've been calling sequels and how we were rating prequels. And historically, I think it was The Phantom Menace might have been the only one that qualified as a prequel that was nominated, and we did not call that a sequel at the time that we were making the formula. So we decided to at least be consistent, and I'll get back to this, but we'll be consistent and call The Hobbit a non-sequel because historically, sequels are less likely to win the Oscar. Sequels seem to be a disadvantage to winning the Oscar.
So you would call, had it made it, Skyfall a sequel?
Yes.
Okay, and you didn't call Avengers a sequel?
Correct, because we were, you know, again, this is a really gray area. Remind me, we'll get back to this. But since the Avengers is not the continuation of a single set of characters, it's a group of all these different characters that we've seen before. We just said, okay, this is not considered a sequel. It doesn't have a two after it. It's not, you know, John McClane in yet another crazy hostage situation. You know, it is a. We just said not a sequel.
Okay, but there's
it wasn't going to be held against it.
There's a certain director who's gone back to his masterpiece, Alien, and you didn't call that a sequel?
Correct, because it is a prequel. And yes, it is the same filmmaker, but as the marketing and the characters, it's not considered Alien. What would that be? Five?
Yeah.
Six? Seven? I don't know.
So would Casino Royale be considered?
Oh, well, good thing it wasn't nominated for an Oscar, because then I'd have to make answer that question. Whew.
Okay, so none of these are considered sequels. But one thing that does...
I'm sorry, going backwards. Even if these were... I mean, the fact that these were not considered sequels or considered sequels, the Life of Pi score was still so strong that it didn't affect who would actually win, projected winner of the Oscar for
okay.
the formula.
Well, there is one thing that's in the same category, right? Which is the main character a CG actor?
Are the primary visual effects, like the thing you think of with the visual effects, are the primary force behind the visual effects, is it character animation?
Okay.
That's the thing. And yes, it absolutely gets into a gray area.
So explain to me, because we discarded this whole discussion on character animation, which of these films would you say, yeah, I think the main thing that I think of when I think of the visual effects of this film is character? And is there a simple yes or no to that, or is there a...
It's a simple yes or no, yeah. Okay. And we said that The Hobbit Part 1, Life of Pi, and Snow White all qualified, because The Avengers and Prometheus did not qualify, even though there's significant character animation in it. The main... primary visual effects of the Avengers, we said that it was about the superheroes, about their amazing abilities, you know, Iron Man flying, Thor flying through the air and electricity and all this stuff. The Hulk plays a part in the film, but it is not the primary. The Hulk is not the primary visual effects of the film.
So that can be a little open to being subjective, isn't it? Because, I mean, Hulk is very much a CG character, but I've got to say, anytime Iron Man's flying around, he's a digital character.
I'm sorry. Maybe I haven't been saying it. Is it organic creature animation?
Ah,
organic.
Okay.
You can probably guess why I had to specify organic character animation, because of years like for Transformers not getting the Oscar opposite the Golden Compass, which had a great deal of... creature animation as opposed to, say, robot animation. If films like Transformers, Real Steel, Transformers 2 and 3, no, Transformers 3, which is nominated, they all get disqualified from that category, because historically the Academy does not look at robots and Iron Man and things like that as Oscar winners. That's why this category exists.
And in fact, I think if I remember correctly, Transformers got a particularly low overall score as a result, didn't it? I mean, if it had been in this year's crop, it wouldn't have rated above any of these films for that reason.
Transformers 1 did fairly well, but it was pretty low. But Transformers 3 got the lowest score of the entire Predictinator's history from 89 to the present.
Okay, so what would be one thing that you would point to in your algorithm that caused Life of Pi to stand out from the pack? Because obviously you had some other things that are a bit this way, a bit that, but it's got to win and it's got to have a strong play in one category.
It's it's Rotten Tomato meter, Rotten Tomato score, which is how we grade critical acclaim, is the second highest after The Avengers. The Avengers had 92%. Life of Pi had 89% of all critics saying that they would recommend it. The Rotten Tomato meter score, critical acclaim, is a big part of the Predictinator. The month of release, just like for Best Picture and Actor Awards, the later in the schedule of the calendar year that the film is released it gives you a greater advantage historically with winning the visual effects Oscar, not only for picture, but for visual effects as well. It's fresher in the Academy's mind. But the real blowout category, particularly this year and last year for Hugo, was additional Academy Award nominations. Life of Pi was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, which was second only to Lincoln, which got 12. Because the films that get a lot of Academy Award nominations end up getting the sound effects editing, they get costume design and cinematography. They're very highly regarded, and it gives you a giant leg up in the visual effects race. The other nominees in visual effects, The Hobbit got 3 nominations total, Snow White got 2, and Avengers and Prometheus only got the visual effects nomination. So that is a significant part of our formula, and with 11 nominations, that's almost like it's the single most important criteria for Life of Pi winning.
So I think, Matt, you and I would agree that if we were putting bets on down the pub, we'd bet on Life of Pi. And in fact, I've had VFX supervisors who are Oscar winners themselves off the record say to me they think Life of Pi was the film to beat. Would you agree, Matt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. And I think, not just for the reasons that Todd lays out, although, God, I mean, it is fascinating hearing sort of how that breaks down. It's just such an interesting set of criteria by which to evaluate it, in the algorithmic sense. Like, it's really, it's so much fun hearing all that breakdown. You're like the Nate Silver of the visual effects Oscar predictions. It's so cool. I just really do feel like that's the film to beat on so many levels. For this visual effects category, and looking at the other films, all of which are really strong, including some of the films we mentioned earlier that didn't wind up, getting the nomination nod via the Bake Off, but I just think that the scope of the work, the diversity of the work, and then the incredible successful execution of the work, for the visual effects branch of the Academy that is voting for the award. I think it's just going to really push it over the top. It just seems like it would be really, I'd be shocked to see it not.
Okay, so let me ask you this question, and Todd, just hang back, you answering on this for a second. So Matt, sure. Life of Pi doesn't get released at the last second because Ang Lee decides that he doesn't want it in stereo and he's going to mono convert his stereo back to mono. And he moves it out of that year. And in its place comes up Dark Knight Rises. Or even forget that. Just leave it with 4. Who'd win if you didn't have Life of Pi in the race? Matt, who do you think could win?
That's difficult. I mean, in which regard, I guess? Like, in terms of the, who do I think would win on the basis of...
Just everything that that's actual awards. Like, instead of Life of Pi, there's another film that we just think of. Okay, let me just stick in, like, Transformers. Like, something that I'm just going to say isn't a contender, not a curveball. Just one that we're okay to say, yeah, that's, not going to win. So you've got 4 films left to consider. Of those, given the Academy, given the voting, given that it's a popularity poll in some respects, what's going to win? Because I can tell you what I reckon that won.
That's a really tough question. I think, for me personally, I would see it as a toss-up between Avengers and Prometheus. I think those are the two, at least for my...
No, there's no question in my mind in that there was a toss-up. It'd be between Hobbit and Avengers. Now, I know you loved The Hobbit, Matt, and it was one of your favorite films of the year. But... I would say to you, okay, well, let's agree to disagree. Before I let you in on this, Todd, and I'm holding you back deliberately because obviously you have some stats on this, I think that The Hobbit was technically innovative, and it's also, let's face it, by all measures, it's come out late in the year. It's a well-known piece of literature. It has real actors in there which, are acting like they're well-known people. And not only that, but, it's not as if people hate Peter Jackson or that, he's never won before and there's some kind of, Hitchcock-style bias against him. And I've got to also say that I think that there was some remarkably good work in The Hobbit. Now, The Avengers, I have to say, still to this day, I think just blows my mind. I mean, to have the last 28 minutes of that film take place in New York, but they only shot there for 3 days. Yeah. Like a third of the film is on a digital backlot. That aqueduct alone had like, what I think it was 230 shots, and it was all just green screen and blue screen. The helicarrier, just the Hulk character animation on that. Mm. I mean, I just think Avengers is a masterpiece, but it's maybe slightly handicapped by the fact that it's got some humor in it. No one ever likes to give humorous things votes for some reason. But I think Avengers is spectacularly good. And for me, it would be between Hobbit and Avengers. But I'm willing to understand that you would go between Avengers and Prometheus. Is that fair to say, Matt?
Yeah, and I think you know, that's a really... I'm weighing in heavily in that respect in sort of a personal taste capacity. And yes, you know, The Hobbit, as you say, for a host of reasons that we don't really have to go into, is certainly not a favorite for me. Although I do think you're right. I do think there is some exceptional work in The Hobbit. Although I would disagree with some of the discussion in the VFX show episode that you guys had, the discussion about The Hobbit. I do think there's also some really bad work in The Hobbit that I think detracts from its overarching successes. And so there's a personal reason, but I do think with regards to the Predictinator, I do think if we're looking at it from the criteria of the Predictinator, I would actually say that I think you're probably right. I think The Hobbit would probably stand a greater chance of winning, given the Predictinator's criteria, if I understand it correctly, if Life of Pi were not in the running.
Okay, so Todd, give us the juice.
Boy, Matt just not like Middle Earth. You know, before the nominations were announced, I was fairly personally convinced, not thinking about Predictinator or anything like that, I was personally convinced that Hobbit was gonna win the Oscar, definitely get nominated, but probably gonna win it because of the track record of the Lord of the Rings films and King Kong, and you know, not to mention the volume of extremely good work in The Hobbit is kind of astounding. The sheer number of shots and the sheer scale and epic of it. I totally thought that was going to be the winner.
Can I ask you a question? Is there any capacity in the algorithm to take into the sort of, I don't know what you call it really, the algorithm? Is there some sort of metric that reflects innovation in that it's the first time it's been done? Because I would say this, if The Hobbit's 48 frames had caused Matt Wallen to go mental because it was the best thing he'd ever seen, in the way that sometimes we've seen visual effects, you know, like let's say Jurassic Park, right? You sort of hadn't seen it before, it caught the imagination, and I feel like that there's part of the Oscar that sort of does tend to reward somebody that did it for the first time. Is that factored in anyway?
We considered that, but it is far too ephemeral and abstract to quantify. Because we wanted to come down with, and eventually was a number. And how can we quantify that Jurassic Park or Terminator 2? Was a giant leap in the craft that we all love.
Do you personally think it influences it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And as much as being a cultural phenomena, like a film like Titanic or Avatar, where it really takes cinema into a different direction for many, many moviegoers. I mean, it's something that the whole world is talking about. I think that absolutely plays a part in it, in addition to being a visual effects landmark film that we're going to be talking about 30 years down the line. But we just couldn't figure out a way to quantify that. And, you know, things like box office and critical acclaim and other nominations, those are numbers, and those are something that we could wrap our head around and, you know, say, okay, this is really what works. But if Life of Pi was not in the running, Avengers has a slight lead over The Hobbit, particularly on two fronts, because they're fairly even on a lot of things, but the tomato meter score, which measures critical acclaim, Avengers had the highest of all the five at 92%, whereas Hobbit was at 65%, which gave Avengers almost
that's
double.
A D.
Okay, and box office. Surely Avengers has been out longer, so it's going to have more box office.
Exactly. We measure domestic box office, and at the time I ran the Predictinator, it was $623 million for the Avengers at $268 for The Hobbit. So that's also like double the point value for box office score. The other categories, month of release and stuff like that, it's it's not a gigantic difference, but it was the box office and the tomato meter score which gave Avengers a slight lead over The Hobbit.
Right, but if Hobbit had suddenly miraculously for whatever reason scored a gazillion Oscar nominations, like, and if it had won every craft category, Hobbit could have then taken the lead and trounced it, kind of thing.
If it got a fourth Academy Award nomination, yeah, probably would have, because we don't even give a film a point unless they hit four Academy Award nominations.
Okay, and the reason I say that is a lot of the other Lord of the Rings films, you know, like nominated in eight categories, kind of thing.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to ask you if we can just spin our heads around for a second, because we've discussed this pretty independent of the companies that have contributed. And so I want to do two things. I want to acknowledge the companies that are behind these films, but also take a bit of a spin on it. And so if Life of Pi wins, it will go to four individuals, and Bill Westenhofer is, lead amongst them. But there's a company we tend to associate with a film if it's the principal house. And so I think it's safe to say that most people would immediately say, oh, Hobbit's a Weta film, in the same way that they would say Life of Pi is a Rhythm and Hughes film, though MPC contributed and one of the nominees is MPC. So I thought what would be interesting to do is just have a look at it in terms of, and I don't know if you've done this, but I have, is just break the films down by nominees. So I don't know if you've ever done this, Todd, but this is what I did, because I felt a bit intimidated coming on with you having all the stats. So what we did is we took every film is nominated by having normally four people in the category, and that's in of itself, I get a bit controversial, because, like, let's face it, more than four people make a film like Avengers. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to pick four, and oh, God knows how they pick who those four are, because if you've got multiple companies, I don't know how many companies contributed to Avengers, but there was, let's face it, not as many companies contributing to The Hobbit, so it was an internal problem as opposed to an external problem on some of the other ones. And if you do that breakdown, you've got 20 people for the five films, obviously four each, and by far the winner in terms of companies here is, forget who wins the Oscar, just in terms of nominees, is Weta Digital, because Weta actually has six nominees, or at least six people that are currently, to the best of our knowledge, working at Weta as we speak, because Weta worked on three out of the five films. So the reason for this is, of course, Prometheus has Martin Hill from Weta, but also Avengers has Guy Williams from Weta. And then, of course, as I said before, if you look at The Hobbit, you've got four members of the Weta team. So that gives them six actual nominees. Second place is Rhythm and Hughes that have two nominees, because even though, as I said, Life of Pi is, in my head, a Rhythm and Hughes film, one of the other nominees is from MPC, and the other one is from Special Effects. And this is an interesting thing that we haven't touched on, which is that of the nominees this year, of those 20, five are practical effects people that you wouldn't consider to be company-based in the way that that we've been talking about. And they're pretty much distributed out, as you'd expect. There's one in Prometheus. There's, I think, two in Huntsman and one in Avengers. And did I miss one? Yes, Life of Pi has one in Donald Elliott. So there you go. And the third in that ranking, which I think is super interesting, is MPC, who worked on two of the five films and has three nominees. And I think MPC in this Oscar discussion could get overlooked. In fact, ILM only has one nominee, and I would tend to say that I think of Avengers as an ILM film first and a Weta film second, probably completely inaccurately, maybe, but based on, I guess, just respect for the ILM work. But so you've basically got MPC having worked on two of the five films and having three nominees. And And that's, I think, pretty significant because MPC is a really good facility. I mean, they do phenomenally good work. I just don't know they've got quite the same profile as an ILM or a Weta. I don't know. What do you guys think, Matt? Do you think would you have surprised you to think that that MPC had sort of three times as many nominees as ILM?
No, you know, I have worked at both companies, so just full disclosure, I had a stint of time at MPC's new Vancouver office at the time on Watchman back in, I think it was 2008, and then I was at ILM for almost 10 years back in the 1990s, in the Wayback Machine. But it doesn't surprise me, you know, and I think the reason for that is, one, I think, you know, for a couple of reasons, I mean, and they're sort of maybe counterintuitive, but I look at ILM and I look at their work now and I look at the level of work that they produce and the consistent high quality of work. I mean, you just look at that, the visual effects reel that's kind of been floating around a few different, you know, sites on the internet, ILM's visual effects reel. That I think was what they showed at the Bake Off for Avengers. And, you know, the work and the execution and the quality, I mean, it is just, you know, top shelf all the way. It's so incredible to look at and just awe-inspiring. And, boy, the ILM PR department, they do an incredible job putting those reels together because they're just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, it's a class in visual effects just watching that stuff. But, you know, that being said, ILM is kind of really the, you know, the old school team on the block in a lot of ways too. I mean, everybody, when you think of visual effects, you think of Industrial Light and Magic. You know, they set the bar, they set the standard, and they've been around for a long time. But then you get, you know, a lot of these sort of smaller companies, and now MPC, which I would have thought of as a smaller company, you know, a number of years ago, it probably was a smaller company then, but it's now, you know, they have several facilities around the world and, you know, some just incredibly top-notch talent working for them. And the kind of work that they're doing and the throughput that they have, you know, the work is being done and executed again at such a high level by just really great professionals. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all, really. They pick up bits and pieces of a lot of work and are the primary house for a lot of shows as well. And I think the bar for their company and the profile for their company has really continued to rise such that I just look at them and I think of them as one of the top visual effects houses in the world in terms of the kind of work that they put out now. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I think it's kind of part of the natural evolution of the business, at least in my history in visual effects, going back to sort of when, you know, there were just two or three shops, you know, and seeing it kind of broaden out. It just seems like part of the natural evolution of things.
I think I said Rhythm and Hues worked on two of the five films. I think it actually only worked on one of the five, didn't it? I think I just made a mistake then. But yeah, MPC certainly worked on two of the five. But I think MPC reflects also the growth in the London houses, because one of the films that I said would have been in was Dark Knight Rises, which is a film completely from Double Negative, and you would have no problem, I'm sure, including Double Negative in a list of, like, you know, one of the top facilities in the world.
Oh, you bet, definitely.
So I don't know that anything's – I don't think ILM has slipped. I think that you've seen a big growth in the European houses, and certainly go back 20 years, that was, you know, there's no way you would say that there's English houses could compete one-on-one with that. And then, of course, Weta is just – an awesome facility. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. It is has an incredible R&D department, amazing depth of people. So in any given year, I think these numbers would, you know, rise and fall. It's not a particularly huge sample. But it is, I think, worth giving MPC some due. I think ILM is spectacularly good, and I take nothing away from it when I say that I think MPC deserves to be in this group. And you know, I can remember going to MPC, God, years and years ago, when they were mainly doing commercials and stuff. And even then, they were just a very well-run facility, very professional. And maybe they don't have quite the same kind of persona as obviously someone that's been going since the dawn of time, like ILM. But man, they've earned their stripes, and good, you know, credit to them.
Yeah,
Mike, I have some instant follow-up for you. You were right. Rhythm and Hughes did work on 2 out of the 5. They worked on Life of Pi, and they contributed to Snow White and the Huntsman.
Oh, Snow White, that was the film. Okay, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say just, I think, too, you know, it's a really, I think it's a positive thing for the industry writ large. You know, I think there is, you know, from time to time we see a lot of, you know, hemming and hawing about the state of the industry and, you know, labor-related issues and stuff. And those are always, you know, super important topics to discuss. I don't mean to belittle them in any way. But I do think, you know, the sort of broad kind of globalization of the industry and then the rising quality of work and the success of a lot of these different visual effects facilities, you know, around the world, it really just speaks to me to the burgeoning success of the industry and of the field that we see the number of houses, you know, sort of, you know, growing and, you know, shrieking to some degree. But overall, I think if you look at the past 20 years, it continues to sort of expand. And we're seeing more films being made with more visual effects work, even, you know, smaller films that, you know, didn't get a nod in the Academy, but films like Flight, you know, that were smaller budget films with, you know, fewer effect shots, but, you know, giving an opportunity to, again, yet, you know, another smaller visual effects house to come out and shine and really do some great work. So I just think it's a positive thing overall.
Yeah, there's definitely a democratization that is happening, not only just with, you know, literal workstations, tools, software, hardware, and things like that. But when I'm just scrolling through some of the Academy Award nominees and winners for visual effects over the last 20 years. And yeah, you've got your Weta's and Digital Domains and Industrial Light and Magic's, but there, you know, there's a lot of Dean Egan here. There's a lot of MPC, as you say, Rhythm and Hughes. Whereas if you go, you know, from say Star Wars to Forrest Gump, it's mainly, you know, an ILM.
Dennis Muren,
you know,
yeah.
Fest. Yeah, it's all Dennis Muren. I just have this big list here, and it just says Dennis Muren.
Okay, I will say, though, that Rhythm and Hughes just is, you know, one of the oldest shops going, right? And so what's interesting, I think, about that is that democratization, in the case of Rhythm and Hughes, wasn't it leaving Rhythm and Hughes, because they clearly won Oscars before. It's that Rhythm and Hughes have distributed themselves, because I don't know if you guys saw the 3D December thing that Autodesk did. They did a lecture, and it was broadcast on the net, and it had one of the Life of Pi guys talking, and he showed a shot where, as we saw with Hugo last year, the shot would move around the world. It would get, you know, 4 different continents working on different parts. You know, one guy works on the water, one guy works on the animal, one guy works on the clouds. It all goes into the same shot as it moves around the world, which is exactly, Todd, what we saw with Hugo last year, wasn't it? Because that was the phenomenon we saw with Hugo's VFX.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think, and they had a really interesting presentation, I believe, at SIGGRAPH this last year, about some of the work on Hugo, if I'm remembering correctly, where they talked about how they were picking up and handing off work, you know, sort of globally around the workday, time zone to time zone to time zone. So really work was never stopping, you know, on a given set of shots within their pipeline, which I think is just so kind of exciting. And you know, we talk a lot about, and Todd, you mentioned this too, and I think it's a great point, you know, the democratization of the tool sets with software and hardware and stuff like that is great. But I also think we're seeing, you know, a really a growth in, you know, sort of education and skill sets and artistry all around the world in a way that is so exciting, such that, you know, on a film like Life of Pi or like you mentioned with Hugo, the workflow can go, you know, from, you know, Los Angeles to... or I guess it would go backwards, right? It could go from what, like India to, you know, London to
Vancouver,
New York or somewhere on the East Coast to, or, you know, Canada or Los Angeles, Vancouver, you know, across back and then back around, you know, to somewhere in maybe somewhere in China or some other place in Asia, and then, you know, back to India, and you can kind of circle around the globe and follow the time zone in order to get a lot of work done and get just incredibly high quality work done by just really gifted artists. And so I think when you see a lot of these facilities building this pipeline, you know, I know we talk a lot about the cost of labor and stuff like that, and those become issues on one front. But I do think there's another advantage for a lot of these companies too, and it's that there is a global talent pool, and to be able to continuously have production ongoing around the clock can really be effective, and it's becoming much more of an effective model as we see with these last few years with these two examples that you just cited, whether it was Hugo or Life of Pi, and I'm sure there's many other examples that maybe I'm not even conscious of.
Let me stick my neck out here at the risk of being decapitated. Are we surprised that a quarter of the nominees are for special effects, given that these films don't smack to me of practical? These aren't, I mean, if I think of practical and this year's films, I would have gone to sort of, Dark Knight Rises, which had, miniatures working. Well, not a lot, but a bit. But I mean, generally speaking, a few years ago, a hell of a lot more miniatures work. I mean, those original Star Wars prequels, tons of miniature work. Nowadays, digital environments are all, pretty much going to be done digitally or set extension out. We surprised that a quarter of the nominees are for practical on sets of?
Not at all. I think, like, particularly, I mean, you think of the Avengers, a lot of that on set, that pyro was on set. That's not miniature stock stuff. It's a lot of real stuff going on around the actors. The rigs that are involved in flipping cars over, and even if it's a blue screen stage, sometimes it's on a giant gimbal that is, like, because I can handle so much weight, it's beyond my capability of understanding it. like Prometheus having those stages that would move side to side. I mean, there's the special effects, the floor effects, sometimes do get the short shrift. We do, because we're, the three of us are visual effects, like digital effects people. We sometimes forget that it is a major, major part of the filmmaking process. And I like that. The Academy pushes for having a special effects nominee included in the four nominees, because it is so incredibly vital.
I will say that it was pretty interesting looking at some of the making of Life of Pi, how they built the wave tank to literally not have reflections back, so that and I got to say, like,
dialable waves.
Yeah,
they could set presets for the kind of mood they wanted for the wave structure. I mean, that's just outrageous.
And it's on a scale, isn't it? When they go, oh, we're just going to sink all these concrete sort of, giant X's to do wave dispersion. You're like, how do you even make a couple of giant X's that are out of concrete and move them, yet alone like 28 of them or whatever it is? Yeah, and those, as you say, even in small films like Flight, that amazing gimbal setup they had. Yeah, it is an engineering feat. And yet, I still think that it's a reflection of respect. Maybe it's a reflection, I don't know what, but it is so hard when you think of the volume of visual effects. I've got to say, I don't think the numbers would stack up. If you were doing a head count, I think the practical effects guys would be vastly less than a quarter of the artists involved in the special and visual effects on these films. I think that they are great people. I'm glad they're represented, but they must be statistically overrepresented on a headcount alone.
Well, yeah, but by that account, there's only one actor. There's only one Mark Ruffalo. And, statistically, a lot more people worked on the Hulk than just Mark Ruffalo. I feel like in terms of the onset experience of the floor effects guys to add atmosphere and to do this stuff that in many cases could be a relatively straightforward setup of a squib going off or an explosion happening behind the actor's head, that could save tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars if we decided to do it all in post. That I think that stuff is still so vital and in tune with preparation for a film, having the special effects and visual effects working in concert with each other, saying, having a real give and take, like, oh, no, it's better if you guys do this on set. It's better if we do this in post.
It's easy to say, oh, my God, that's a daunting thing that the special effects guys did, building this or building that. And I'm not trying to take everything away from them, but I think it's daunting that some bunch of guys, or I think four teams, went into New York and did 2,000 panoramas and LiDAR scans of the streets of New York and built New York. I think it's remarkable that the guys, I think that ILM, I presume at ILM, you know, built that helicarrier, which had like 40 gigabytes of textures alone and was just off the dial complex. And I just think it's, sometimes with the digital stuff, it's almost too hard to get your head around. Whereas you can kind of, I mean, I can imagine how hard it is to move a concrete pylon into a wave tank. I can't begin to understand how I'd go about documenting New York digitally. It's like, really? And get a consistent time of day and get it all stitched together. And then, I mean, I don't know, it's just, it's a too hard to get my head around problem. But hey, I don't mean to dish on the special effects guys, but there is such depth to the visual effects, such complexity to what's going on. I don't know.
I wonder if we'll get to a point like I've – and there are actually others who have been saying that the Academy needs to make a
– split the categories.
To have a new category that includes stunt and floor effects, stunt and special effects. It's kind of crazy that stunt work is not
that's true
represented at the Academy Awards, and I think that'd be kind of cool. Maybe that would be because the digital work, the particularly post production work that is happening on these films is monumental.
Yeah, that's a great point. But you know, there is talk too, though, from time to time that I've heard murmurings of. I think in the Hollywood Reporter and stuff, occasionally you hear talk about the idea of maybe separating out even some of the more technical awards for sound mixing and visual effects and not having them at the actual awards ceremony and doing them like the Sci-Tech Oscars, which, you know, I can understand from a, you know, mom and pop at home watching the show, maybe just being really concerned with sort of the top, you know, five awards or so, or six awards or something, you know, and wanting to shorten the program for ratings purposes and stuff. But I do think, too, you know, the longer the show gets and the fewer opportunities for people from, you know, sound or costume or, you know, visual effects to get an opportunity to get up on the stage, you know, it sort of lowers the visibility of those professions in the eyes of the general public in a way as part of sort of the overall process of filmmaking. And I think it would be a shame to do that. So, you know, I wonder if they really will ever do something like that where they add more award categories than start to add fewer.
Also, Sci-Tech is not a this year award. I mean, if you win an award, okay, the guys that won one of the Sci-Techs this year is for wavelet technology that was to work with Sims. It was really amazingly innovated. As it so happens, it doesn't tend to get used pretty much that much today in 2013 as it would have like even 2 years ago. But it's a great innovation, and it's being recognized today. You know, PSDs are being recognized, and they've been around for ages. So, you know, there's a very different vibe to the Sci-Techs. It's not this instant. It's like body of work and deliberately thus. So, yeah, I would hate to see visual effects moved out of the main. I mean, I would just scream blue murder. I think it's just...
I wouldn't, yeah, frankly... In 10 years, I wouldn't be surprised that visual effects and cinematography editing, the short films, I wouldn't be surprised if it became its own award ceremony.
I'll tell you one reason why they wouldn't want that to happen, and I think it's a really callous one, but I'm going to say it anyway. The problem with the Oscars is that the films that tend to get nominated, especially not necessarily this year, but a couple of years ago, were all independent small films that no one had bloody gone to see. And the visual effects category brings in big blockbuster titles. And you want the Joss Whedons and you want, you know, the Avengers in that sort of makeup of films. And if it's not going to get recognized in other categories, then it's not going to be part of the Oscars. And you're going to end up with this kind of arty-farty to the general public Oscars that's all about, you know, stars, but films that are they're not going to go and see. Remember there was one Oscars about 4 or 5 years ago where the host, I think it was Chris Rock, went to a multiplex and said, have you seen this film, this film, this film? They're like, nah, nah, nah. And he goes, okay, have you seen these films? They're like, yep. And none of those were nominated, right? And it was all like they'd all seen the sort of crappy comedies that no one would ever consider for an Oscar, and none had seen the Best Picture nominee. So I, for that reason alone, I think they're going to keep visual effects in the main.
Can I change? So. I just did one more thing. I did this last year. I charted out the average gross box office gross. You can talk about popularity of the different categories. The average box office gross of each of the nominees for every category. And I might do it again this year, but I'm just looking here at some of my notes. For Best Picture right now, the average gross for the 9 nominees is $91 million, which is actually really impressive. I'm scrolling down to visual effects. The average gross is for visual effects films, $260 million in the United States.
And let's face it, they widened the Best Picture category to get in more popular films. So exactly. In previous years, I could imagine that number being a lot lower than 91.
Yeah, hey, that's pretty high.
So you haven't done any stats on this, but just by way of conversation as we finish up the show, I would not feel comfortable not touching on Best Animated Feature because there's spectacular work there. Nominees being Brave, Frankenweenie, Paranormal, Pirates, Band of Misfits and Wreck-It Ralph. I think Wreck-It Ralph was the surprise inclusion there, though my daughters think it's the best film they've ever seen. at least one of them loves it to death. But I would say that Brave, from just a purely personal point of view, will take it home because it is just a really good film. I don't know that it's the best Pixar film Pixar's ever made, but I think it has a lock on it. And certainly, I'd be interested to see what happens over in the Best Cinematography category, where, again, some really good films, including Life of Pi, but also Lincoln and Skyfall and things up for grabs. Do you guys have any opinion on Best Animated Feature?
Just in terms of cinematography, I'm personally, boy, could Roger Deakins finally win his first Oscar for Skyfall? For a James Bond movie? Can you believe it?
That would be so good if he did.
I mean, I really hope so. I mean, I thought the cinematography in Skyfall, especially, I just loved that scene at the end at the Skyfall sort of family home with the fire and the at night and stuff. I just thought that stuff was just absolutely stunning and gorgeous. I mean, that would be so neat to see him win. On the animated feature front, I'll be honest with you, like, I saw all those films, and my son, who is 9, he also loved Wreck-It Ralph, thought it was just the coolest thing. And, you know, that was a fun movie. I had a couple friends, good buddy Matt Dugan, who used to work with me at ESC Entertainment, he worked on that film, and said it was just great fun, had a great time working on it, and it was a lot of great work. But I actually really enjoyed this year both Frankenweenie and Paranorman, with, you know, sort of the more traditional, you know, some stop motion animation, and I would love to see more of those kind of films in the animation category. I mean, you know, Pixar, of course, always does just great, great work. And it's, you know, it's almost in a league unto itself. And I think, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see it win, but I would love to see some of the, you know, traditional stop motion animation films pick up an award here and there from time to time. And I really enjoyed both of those this year.
Yeah, the guys that did Paranormal are really good guys. And I've got to say, in the office here, they think that Tim Burton's going to work away with the Oscar. They think I'm completely wrong with saying Brave will. Though I will think I'm maybe confusing technical excellence and what I think the Academy will vote for. But I would vote for Brave. That's all I guess.
I saw 4 out of the 5 films. I didn't see the Pirates. I really loved Brave, but Paranorman really took me by surprise. I didn't really have any expectations, and within the first sequence, I was like, boy, this animation is really good. I really liked it. But my prediction and vote would probably be for Brave. I thought it was really beautiful.
I got to say, on cinematography, I got to talk to Janusz Kaminski last week, which was kind of interesting. And he's certainly published some really interesting pieces, and I love his work, and what an amazing collaboration with Spielberg after so many years. But his work in Lincoln, while really, really great, it was, I felt, work that set a stage that had beautiful lighting and then just sort of stepped back and allowed the artists to act, you know, almost stage-like way, and he said this himself. And I take nothing away from his lighting, but I feel like there are scenes in Skyfall where Deakins just delivered all of the emotional punch that the scene had of two people sort of walking away from a fire through his lighting and through his cinematography in a way that I just, you know, and even Life of Pi, as magnificent as that is so influenced by the digital work that I think maybe that, you know, from a cinematography voting point of view, that would get a little confusing as to what was the DOP's work. I can't say I've seen Anna Karenina. Have you guys seen that?
No, I have not.
So I mean, we can't really talk about it in any, but I'm totally with you. If I heard Deacon talk at Sidgraph, I think he was.
At Sidgraph, yeah.
I mean, what a treat. If anyone ever gets a chance to hear Roger Deacon's talk, he is amazing and has a lot of...
So smart, and what a funny guy too. Like, oh, I mean, he told some really funny stories. The one about working with, I believe it was Mr. Pablo Hellman at Industrial Light and Magic. He told a great story about working with him and about sort of his take on some of the visual effects and, you know, having to stop and start with regards to the, you know, effects work and feeling like, you know, well, hey, that's not really necessary, you know. Pablo could do it, right? I think was his line, and he was just great. Great fun.
Pablo said we can roto it, you know?
His next line was to Pablo was, hang on a second, in this shot or for the rest of my career?
Yeah.
And yes, but you know what I mean? Like there was such that end sequence of Skyfall was just, but it wasn't alone. You know, there were other sequences that were completely different color palettes.
Well, yeah, the other sequence where they arrive at the, was it like at a, like a casino, like the kind of Asian themed casino with, and the super like just juicy saturated lighting and stuff of him arriving on the boat. And it's those colors. I mean, wow. That stuff was just
stupidest sequence ever, right? Like you have a high traffic. Anyone been to Vegas? Like you get into a casino carrying a large alcoholic beverage on some sort of mass form of public transport. You don't get herded in on an individual boat through. But anyway, I'd agree it was a magnificent looking shot. I just was looking at it going, what? Why is he on this stupid boat?
But that range and diversity.
Oh, no, work, totally.
You know, on a cinematography level, like to see that all in one film as part of sort of the visual palette of the picture, I think was just amazing. And I mean, he's just really such an incredible talent.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, that Hollywood will see. I don't necessarily like it when they give Oscars to folks for their body of work as opposed to that particular year's entry. But boy, you know, with Roger Deakins, particularly his work with the Coen brothers and my favorite like Coen brothers film of recent memory was No Country for Old Men. I mean, this guy is one of the great cinema artists, Roger Deakins. And boy, I hope he walks away with it.
And interesting for people listening to this show, he has a very active role in sort of DreamWorks type consulting work. I think he also consulted to Pixar, didn't he, on Up? It wasn't Up. It was
he consulted on Rango. I know that.
Yeah, but I think he also consulted on...
WALL-E?
WALL-E, yeah. And got the cinematographers to understand what a pan would really look like with the offset that the tripod provides and getting that hunt and look on the focus and stuff that just really... I mean, I even from the trailer thought, hang on, somebody's done something at Pixar because this is looking very cinematic. Yeah, so there are no reasons in the world why you couldn't get behind Roger Deakins. Great guy, very experienced across a lot of different genres and certainly the film alone. And look, you know, it's been critically, I mean, I've got some minor criticisms with the plot, but he certainly didn't write it. He shot it. And just because they ridiculously drop tubes out of the air for no reason is no reason to not film them properly.
Going off of what you said, you know, yeah, he didn't write it. But going back to Rhythm and Hues, you know, just from a facility point of view, you know, we all have friends that work in Rhythm and Hues and they do extraordinary work. But boy, you know, sometimes work is work. And when they've become admittedly the industry leaders in talking animals and cartoons turned into live action features, with was it Alvin and the Chipmunks and the Cats and Dogs films and Yogi Bear and you know, these films aren't exactly, you know, you don't want to put your arms around these films and watch them over and over again. There's a part of me that if Life of Pi, you know, the Life of Pi is getting all this acclaim, the work is so gorgeous that all of those films were stepping stones to achieving Richard Parker and achieving that orangutan and the hyena, and just the extraordinary fidelity of that work. The industry is so happy that Rhythm and Hues has worked on a film that we can all just embrace and love for filmmaking, for art, and putting something out there that we can all enjoy. I'm really happy for them on the facility level.
I've got to say, there's just no doubt in my mind that one metric, obviously, you can't really factor into an equation. But if there was a film that I had an emotional connection with, it was Life of Pi. It is art, and it is magnificent, and the visual effects artists are gods, and they should be treated as thus, because it's just amazing work.
I listened to your podcast on it, and of course, after I saw the film, and I agree with you 100%. I had, just from a personal level, I totally connected with that film. I thought I'm a big Ang Lee fan, and he did not disappoint. That film was just extraordinary. And it would, you know, I read, I think it was an FX guy, that Ang was looking forward to making art with Rhythm and Hues, and boy, did they ever.
I can let you in a little secret, not such a big secret. I got on the line with Bill to discuss that film because we'd already done a story about it. But when it came out, and of course now it's Oscar time, so we thought we'd revise it. And we had revisions, well, not revisions, we had additional material covering things like Avengers. And so it was only fair we should do additional material on something like Life of Pi. First thing Bill says on the phone to me, and I'm sure you guys will appreciate this, especially Matt, he said, "Hey, I listened to the VFX show on Life of Pi." Pause. Mm. And I went, "Yeah." And he went, "You got most of it right."
So, yeah, most. All right.
I was like, okay. Otherwise,
good.
This was going to be a very short interview. Anyway, that's coming up on FX Guide. Hey, guys, thanks so much for being with us. If you want to check out Todd's amazing work in The Predictinator, which is, as I say, to be totally applauded for just trying to offer an interesting perspective on the Oscars. Todd, where can they have a look?
They can go to FX Rant. fxrant.blogspot.com.
And Matt, if people want to follow and find you, where can they do that?
Yeah, hey, great to be on a show finally with you, Todd, and super fun chatting with you. But yeah, you can always find me. I'm at Virginia Commonwealth University. Here we are in the middle of the spring semester, rolling along. And at my website, which is mattwallen.com.
And Todd, I don't think we got your Twitter handle, did we?
No, it's TVAZIRI. TV is area Twitter.
Brilliant. And of course, you can find me over at FXGuide or FXPhD, and I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. But I just want to thank you guys so much for being on the show. I want to thank you guys for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I have. I was really looking forward to this show. It's always good to be able to discuss the quality of work that and look, I had a pretty public splat with someone earlier in the year when they said that they didn't think visual effects was that interesting this year, and I just say, you know, I'm not going to say what I'm going to say to that, but I'm just going to point to these films and say, hey, wow, you know, what a spectacular body of work to all those artists that were both nominated and just worked on the films. Congratulations for an outstanding year. And as an audience member, thank you so much. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.